All right, good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone here. I'd also like to welcome the snow, which joined us today. And today's discussion, continuing in this course of fascinating facts, we are going to move in a different direction. Last week we began with the discussion of the Bible, going through details and facts and fiction or myths within the Bible. Today we will discuss life cycles. That will say sunrise, sunset, exploring the Jewish life cycle. There's an old saying from Groucho Marx. It says, "I must admit, I was born at a very young age." Yeah, birth. And regarding death, you have the statement of, I believe it was Gandhi, who said, "You should live every day as if you will die tomorrow, and you should learn every day as if you're going to live forever." So we have different visions of life, of birth, of death. Today we will discuss both, as well as different events that happen in between. There is a question sheet placed around the table with several questions, which hopefully we will address throughout today's talk. Again, last week we did run out of time before we were able to go through all of the discussions properly. That will probably happen again today because it's also a very pertinent, very important topics of life, all the different events that happen throughout life. And perhaps, you know, let's open with this video, which is just to get us into the mode of the various stages of life, which we will discuss throughout the course. Okay. So today's discussion will go through, in rather quick fashion, the various stages of life. And I guess the opening question really is, what is the celebration of life itself? I know it's one of the questions here is the Jewish tradition. In the Jewish tradition, a birthday is just a hallmark event, a Facebook event, a meaningful event. And the opening question is, what is the celebration of life? We celebrate a birthday. You know, people will go and we'll have major celebrations, we gather a party, we gather together, just to celebrate the fact that today is my birthday. Today, 35 years ago, I was born. What is being celebrated? Is life itself a reason to celebrate? Perhaps the most common celebration is a birthday party. And then there's the more meaningful birthday parties, the 30th, the 40th, the 50th, the 60th birthday. And they're meaningful. Why? Because now I have lived 60 years. But what's being celebrated? What's the very celebration of birth? Perhaps it's because we're simply looking for a reason to celebrate, right? We need an excuse to party, so we find a birthday is an excuse to party, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But perhaps there really is something more meaningful when it comes to a birthday. Let's open with a light learning activity on page 38. And I would really appreciate, I guess, if there's input. I'd appreciate if we actually have opinions in regards to the question posed. I'm assuming everyone here has a book. If not, there are several extra books here. So below are some metaphors for life. Underline the one that resonates most with you, or add a metaphor of your own. Be prepared to explain your choice. We have several options here. Perhaps you have one of your own. Take a moment. Give one which you can relate to. Life is a game which we all play, so perhaps. All right, any suggestions? Or you can make up your own. This is your own original thinking. Any ideas?
Life is like a coin. You can spend it any way you wish, but you only spend it once.
Okay. There's no wrong answer. This is the one which you connect to. I mean, they all make sense, right? Any other ideas here?
Life is a roller coaster. Just get on it and ride it.
I should say, ups and downs. Hopefully we're on the up. Perhaps we're upside down. It's a roller coaster. Yes.
Life is a great big canvas, and you
should
throw all the paint on it you can.
There you go. Okay, good. I liked one which I've heard. It's not on this sheet of paper, but it's that life is 5% reality and 95% what you make of it. I remember hearing that once, and that's in my mind. It's, you know, reality is the way you your attitude towards life is really what's going to determine how you live. Any other ideas? Any other original thoughts, original lines? All right. So, again, there's no right, there's no wrong. There's life is a, nobody relates to life is like a box of chocolates, no? Okay. No? So, life is like, well, the bottom one is life is like a bowl of cherries. And one of the lines, I think it's Irma Bombeck who says regarding that, if life is box of what am I doing in the pits? Right. All right. The truth is, yes.
5% reality and
90%
when you make the
step. That's the line I want. That's not mine. That's the one I heard, and I enjoyed that one. Okay. So there is a metaphor for life, which is expressed in the Talmud as well. And that is expressed on text in B. I guess it's page number 38. Again, we will go around the room. As we read the text, you're welcome to read the text or to pass it along to the next person who will read. So text B on page 38. Oh, is it already? Where is it? 39, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
Does the Torah have a metaphor for life? It does indeed. Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, clever one, hurry and eat, hurry and drink, because the world from which we must depart is like a wedding feast.
So Shmuel, one of the leading sages in the Talmud, tells his sharpest student, who's called Clever One, he was called Shinina, which means Clever One, he tells him, hurry and eat, hurry and drink, life is like a wedding feast. What's the significance of what he's saying? What does that even mean? And truth to be told, in a sense, it's misleading. Because one may think that this follows the logic of eat, drink, and be merry. That's what life is about. When in the prophet Isaiah, he strongly condemns those who say life is about eat, drink, and be merry. Rather, the depth of this statement was something more than just eat, drink, and be merry. The idea here was that life is like a smorgasbord. It's like a big buffet. And you have to take it as you move along the buffet or the smorgasbord or the celebration. Grab what you can because it's not going to be there for long. One of the most powerful messages I've heard, it's not a statement of life, but really an idea, was a book which was written, perhaps some of you are familiar with the episode of a young man who passed away in his teenage years. His name was Miles Levin. He was a boy from Detroit. I know his father, and I've read some portions of his book, which he writes as he goes through his illness, he describes his illness. One of the more powerful statements I read there was where he told over how that, or previously, recently he had gone to a golf driving range. And the driving range, he said, he purchased a bucket filled with golf balls. And then, you stand by the driving range, you start hitting, right? So you take this, put the golf ball down, you hit. You put another one down, you hit. You just don't even think. You just keep on hitting. You don't pay attention. Was it a good hit? Was it a weak hit? And then, he says that, and then at some point you look down and you see that there aren't that many left. So all of a sudden you start paying attention. He says, now when I stood and I made sure to hit it, it was straight and it was far. And then as the buckets was less and less, each ball I focused on a little bit more, made sure that it was a proper hit. And then he concludes, he says, today I found out, my doctor told me that I only had a year and a half left to live. And the message was powerful and clear, that when you realize, well, there's only so much left, all of a sudden you pay much more attention to each day. But the truth is that each ball is as valuable as the last one. The first one is no less valuable than the last. We just don't realize it. And perhaps that's the message we're saying here. He's saying here that it's a wedding, it's a smorgasbord. You have to grab when the opportunity comes. Don't wait till later. Every day, today, is as important as your last day. I'm sorry? Oh. You don't agree, or?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just scratching.
Oh. Sorry. So this is a statement. That life is not at all the idea of life is a wedding, just enjoy it. Eat, drink, and be merry. Life is definitely a time to enjoy it, but it's not an attitude of frivolousness. Rather, it's an attitude to capture every moment. But the question is a little bit further as we examine this somewhat deeper. Perhaps we'll come to a deeper significance of life itself, and that is, why the wedding? The example given is a wedding. Why is it that life is compared to a wedding? You can argue that this is any event, any meal really. You say, well, grab it when you have the opportunity. Take this opportunity. So when it comes to a wedding, there's really a deeper message here, which carries a deeper significance to life, to every portion of life, starting from birth all the way till passing. And this is expressed in text number 1 on page 40.
Man and woman are compared to a soul and body. This world is like a wedding feast, because the fusion of the spiritual soul and the physical body, which is this world, is similar to the union of bride and groom, a wedding feast.
So here's where we have the deeper, the mystical, the Kabbalistic interpretation of this idea. Why a wedding? Because a wedding is a combination, is a joining of two beings which are very different. However we put it, men and women are different. And we bring them together in an improbable union. And that union is very powerful. Life is the same. Life is constantly a union of body and soul. Two very different entities, two opposite entities. A body which demands self. A body which wants to indulge. A body which is selfish. Together with the soul which looks out for others. Which is selfless. Which wants to make the world holier and better. We are made up of these two entities. Life is a wedding. Life is a combination, is a blend of two very different beings together. And that is the fusion of life, and that's the purpose of life. Not a body and not a soul, but a body and a soul together. When the soul could enter the body and cause that a selfish being could be selfless and cause us to look out for others as opposed to only looking out for ourselves, that is the essence of life. And that's why it's not just any celebration. It's a celebration of a wedding, which brings together two separate beings into one, which we will talk about a little bit further when we go into the discussion of marriage. But again, this is going to be the common thread. Instead of just focusing on birth, and we'll talk about circumcision and bar mitzvah and wedding and passing, there is one common thread, is if we see life constantly as a fusion between body and soul, as this wedding of body and soul, then everything looks a little bit different. Everything has that background of a body and soul coming together. A second point here is that a wedding is a time we celebrate with others. All weddings are celebrating with others. And life, too, is a celebration which is shared. In the Jewish perspective, my life is not only my life. I can't go through life simply looking at myself. I have to recognize my life is part of a greater unit, part of the universe, part of the Jewish people, part of the whole world. And everything I do affects others. And that's why when you think about the traditional greetings given at Jewish events, they always are connected to other people. Right? We talk about at the bris. This morning I was at a bris, at a circumcision. And over there, the customary wish when the child, after the circumcision, we say, Kishem shenichnas labris. Just as this child was brought into circumcision, this child should be brought into Torah, wedding, umatzin tovim, and good deeds. We wish that this person, this child, will then influence others with good deeds. At a wedding, the customary greeting, aside from mazel tov is a general greeting we give in every situation, is the customary greeting is that they should build a binyan adiyad al yisodei haTorah v'haMitzvah, an everlasting home on the foundation of Torah, mitzvot, Torah, and good deeds. And finally, when one is menachem avel, one goes to console one who is sitting shiva, the greeting is, hamakom yinachem eshem, v'soshar aveli tiyim v'yushalayim. May you be comforted among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. In all three instances, we find that we include this person, the greeting to this person extends to everyone. Good deeds will cause everyone. May you be comforted among all the mourners of Zion. Because a person is not living an individual life. We do. We are living our own lives, but our lives influence others. We are part of a universal mission, a universal Jewish mission. We're all on a boat. We all have our own little room. But if we put a hole in the floor of that room, it's going to affect the entire boat. We're affecting everyone. So we have our individual lives. But our lives affect and influence others, positively and negatively. And this perhaps is another indication of this idea of a wedding. Having said this, let's begin. Right in the beginning of life. And so the understanding would be, the question is, when does life begin? What is the definition of birth? So I once heard that according to Judaism, birth is when a child emerges from medical school. That's what I heard in Jewish understanding. But the truth is, most of us understand that birth, the beginning is, well, when the child is born, that's when it begins. Truth to be told, according to the mystical teachings of the Kabbalah, the child, the birth, or the beginning, really begins a lot earlier. So I think this is intended to discuss what we said earlier, the body and the soul fusion becomes you. And this actually should be later. Maybe we'll get back to that slide. So, the text 2a tells us that life, or the influence in the child, begins a lot before birth. Text 2a on page 41, please.
The fetus is taught the entire Torah. As it enters this world, an angel approaches and slaps it on its mouth and causes it to completely forget the entire Torah.
This is a strange statement. The fetus is taught an entire Torah. In the womb, the soul of the baby is taught an entire Torah. What is the significance of this? First of all, what's the purpose of this? So let's say, obviously this is a deeper mystical teaching, but what would be the purpose of studying the entire Torah and then forgetting it? So what's explained is that there is, perhaps some of you are familiar with this idea of deja vu, right? You go into a room or into a home or to a place and you think, I've been here before, I recognize this. So the same could be with music, same could even be with the sense of smell. Something that I can't consciously think about where and when I was exposed to this, but I know at some point I was. And there is this idea that our conscious today, it's very from perhaps several hundred years ago, before we were more aware of the subconscious, this would sound strange to study Torah to forget it, but today we are aware of the fact that certain things which we have imprinted on, in our mind since we're infants or children affect us later. I remember hearing about a study of children, newborns, were in the hospital or immediately afterwards, they had headphones, and some of the children in America were given headphones which were language spoken was French. And then later in life, when these children were older and they were taught French, these children were able to pick it up significantly quicker than other children, because it had somehow registered in their mind and the language was... Today, it is very commonly understood and believed that a child in the womb is affected by music, is affected by relationships. You have all the time. They tell fathers, first-time fathers, to speak to the child while the child is in the stomach. And there's all sorts of things which can affect the child. And this is a Jewish belief as well. The child is affected while in the womb. It's studying Torah in the womb. And then it forgets everything. But why is it taught so that later, when it re-establishes its search for Torah, it'll be comfortable with Torah because it was already taught it in the womb? This is a mystical idea, and there is the reason behind it. Text 2b is from Rabbi J.B. Soloveitchik, who is the rabbi of Yeshiva University. An interesting point, which is mentioned in the biography, is that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave smicha. He ordained more rabbis than anyone else in history as the leading rabbi of Yeshiva University. Anyway, so he expresses this in text 2b.
Every Jew comes into the world with a natural responsiveness to Torah teaching. Every Jew begins with a share in Torah that was vested in him before his birth. And though he is made to forget it, it is preserved in the deep recesses of his soul, waiting to be awakened by studying and faith of one's own.
So that's the explanation of this idea. But as a more practical expression of this, being that the influences on the child begin earlier, so just as it's clear that in a physical sense, the mother takes extreme care during pregnancy of her health, because she knows her health is going to affect the child. Physicality and spirituality mirror one another. The spiritual actions of a mother affect the child while in the womb. For today, a story about a father, first-time parents, or expecting parents. They go to the class or the workshop for first time, and the leader tells the father to put on a sandbag, which is 10 pounds, so you understand what it means to be pregnant. He puts on the sandbag, and he feels what it's like, and he says, this is not too bad. And then she puts a pen on the floor. He says, now pick it up. He says, you want me to pick it up like my pregnant wife would? He said, yeah. Tempter's wife says, honey, can you pick up the pen, please? No, but on an opposite note, I heard today a different idea that men, we have a hard time allowing room for people even outside of us. And a woman who's pregnant makes room for a full life inside of her. I must say that I and my wife, God willing, we are expecting a child as well. And I have all the respect and give credit due to the woman who goes through the pregnancy and the holding the child within her for 9 months. But there's no question that during these moments of pregnancy, there's a strong effect on the child, physically and spiritually too. And therefore, and the custom is that women who are pregnant will pay extra care to several mitzvahs. In the text 3D, it talks about a woman who spent time listening to Torah classes, listening to Torah lectures while she was pregnant, so that not only she would be affected, but that the child in the womb would be affected. And this was something, her child ended up with Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah, one of the great sages in the Talmud, and this was, it began a lot earlier. There was a person who approached a sage and said, I just had a child, when does the process of education begin? And his response was, you came 9 months late. The process of education for a child spiritually begins when the woman is pregnant, right at the beginning of pregnancy. And there are different customs. There are those who have the custom of adding in charity during that time, making sure to check the mezuzahs. Many people will do that when a woman's pregnant. She'll make sure to check the mezuzah on the bedroom door so that her home is protected. Shabbos candles, areas which are not only for themselves but for the child as well. And this is the beginning of the influence of a child is well before birth, is during pregnancy. Having said this, we now move to the moment of birth. And here's where we have an important point, which is that the soul enters the body in stages. The body, the original entrance to the fusion of the body and soul is at the moment of birth. But then we have the stages of the Brit Milah, circumcision, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, a wedding. Each of these stages, the soul becomes more complete within the body. So the first step is the soul entering the body at the moment of birth. And therefore, going back to our original question, which is, what is the significance of a birthday? The answer is, a birthday represents the time where my body and soul became one, and where my mission in this world of bringing holiness to the animalistic aspects of this world began. And every year on my birthday, it's a time to reflect on what is the essence of life. Life is a mission. Life is a purpose to bring holiness, to bring selflessness to a selfish world, to bring holiness to a coarse world. That is what life is. When did that happen? That happened upon birth. When the soul entered the body, that's what happened. And every year of birthday, we celebrate my mission. I celebrate my purpose of life itself. So birthday is very unique. Life itself is worth celebrating. Not only momentous occasions, such as a wedding, obviously something exciting, perhaps the purchase of a new home, a new car, something to celebrate. Life itself is a celebration. It represents the idea of a soul in a body, the idea of the purpose in life to bring holiness to where there is none. And that's what a birthday really is. And going back, and there was a slide earlier, there are several customs which are intended to be done on a birthday precisely because of this unique idea of what a birthday is. The first idea is that a birthday is considered an appropriate time for reflection. A second custom which people have on a birthday is to take upon themselves a new mitzvah, being that the mitzvah is the perfect way to infuse the physical world with spiritual meaning. A mitzvah, a birthday is the perfect time to do it, whether the mitzvah is in prayer or in Shabbat or in any area of my life, whether it's between me and God or me and my fellow person. It's a special time to do so. A third custom people have is adding a little bit in charity on their birthday to bring kindness, to show selflessness on this day. A fourth custom people have is to say psalms. Now this is interesting. Every person has a psalm. The Tehillim is made up of 150 psalms written by David. It's the universal book of prayer. But we all have a psalm which is connected to my age. Whatever your age is, your psalm is one more than that. So if a person is 37, their psalm is number 38. The reason is because the first year of life, the child is zero, and the psalm is the first psalm, which is number one. So every year the psalm will be one up. So therefore the custom is to pray for one who is ill. And the custom is to say Tehillim, to say psalms for that person. Which psalm is said? We say the psalm of that person's age. So if someone is ill and they're 55, we would say psalm number 56. So every person has their own psalm. So many have a custom to say their psalm every day. Therefore, a birthday represents a new psalm, which is a perfect time to study that psalm, to study it, and that's a custom many have. With that, we won't get too far into this, but there is a Jewish birthday which follows the Jewish calendar, which is very easy to find out. Today, you can go online to find out what exactly is your Hebrew birthday, what the Hebrew day you were born on, and every year, what day that would be. Another addition to add in prayer, which really can be connected to the first custom of reflection, there is an important aspect of a birthday of celebrating, sharing with others, going and having a party with others. But the party should be significant, should be where I'm able to talk serious matters. Yes, you have a party, you have food, you can bring out a cake, but it should also be because life is serious, because life is special, it's powerful. It's a time to share, not just to party for the sake of partying, but party and inspire others with this message of what a birthday is all about. There are those who have a new fruit, which gives an opportunity to make the blessing of Shachianu, to go to the supermarket and buy fruit, which one had not had throughout the year. And finally, it is a special time to get an aliyah. If it's an aliyah, if the Torah is being read in shul on Mondays or Thursdays or Shabbat, a birthday is a special time to get an aliyah at the Torah as well. Now, I've mentioned to people that when it comes to a party, there really can be two opposite reasons to have a party. Many people will say, I'm having a birthday, let's go to the bar, and let's drink. Have a party. And the underlying message here is, let's party to escape reality. Life is filled with troubles, filled with worries, filled with burdens. When I party, I'm able to escape who I am for a couple of hours, and just go to reality, which is not true. Escape myself. And the truth is, when we talk about a birthday party in this sense, it's the exact opposite. Yes, you should celebrate, but the celebration should be finding yourself, not escaping who you are, but going deeper into who you really are, the purpose of who you are. Not getting caught up with the shallowness of life, but finding what is life all about? What is my purpose? What is my purpose in life? And how can I accomplish that in the coming year? And you party. It's a reason to celebrate, but it's a meaningful celebration. And as opposed to the other celebration, where the next morning a person usually wakes up with a hangover and a feeling of just nothingness. What have I accomplished? I wasted an evening, I drank, I wasted money, I didn't accomplish anything. Here you can have a celebration and you wake up the next morning in a sense of fulfillment. I accomplished something yesterday. I have a plan. I know what I want for myself. I know what I want from life. And that itself is reason to celebrate. So that's the significance of a birthday. A birthday is very unique. It's very powerful. And it's very deep when celebrated properly. We move on to the idea of a birth, of a bris milah, and naming. So we're going to move along. I know we're skipping several of the texts. You can read it on your own, and also as you send questions afterwards via email or phone call. On page number 44, it discusses circumcision. Now, circumcision is an extremely, even though there are many commandments in Torah, circumcision, for whatever reason, has become one of the most fundamental ideas within Judaism. And we see today it's part of who we are, the idea that Judaism across the board, Jewish people of all circles, circumcision is done. One of the explanations is that Abraham was the first Jew and he put his life on the line for circumcision. So he caused that all of his children after him, whatever level of religiosity they may be, circumcision is part of who they are. And circumcision is done on all children. And what people don't know, because circumcision is considered the way to perfect the body, which is why circumcision is done even on, God forbid, a stillborn, or a person who throughout their life did not do circumcision for whatever reason, and they pass away, and the Hever Kadisha, what's the English word for Hever Kadisha? The
Burial
Society, right. Burial Society will circumcise that person because part of the Jewish belief, as is expressed by Maimonides, is the idea that there is revival of the dead, chiyas hameisim. And when the body will come back, it should be a good body, it should be a perfect body. So circumcision is something which is done. Still, it's something which is a major part of Jewish belief. Again, it's one of the commandments, but it's considered bris milah. The very term circumcision is called bris milah, as a covenant. It is the binding covenant that exists between man and God. Now, if circumcision is so important, so why is there no circumcision or acts of something similar, circumcision by women? So here you have text number 5. Short text. And go ahead.
A woman is considered circumcised.
Okay, so a woman is considered circumcised. So the original reaction, the initial reaction is, well, perhaps it's just so that we should feel equal, right? That men and women are equal, so men are circumcised and women are circumcised. This idea, though, was expressed several thousand years ago, which was before the feminist movement required that everyone should be equal. And at that point, you didn't necessarily have this feeling. But more so, this is a practical legal application that women are considered circumcised. And I'll explain that. What this means is as follows. The Talmud talks about vows. In the Torah, vows are very important. One who takes a vow is bound to that. If one vows and says, I will not have anything to do, I will not speak to anyone who is circumcised. The Talmud says that includes men and women. So the only people that person can speak to then would be a male who is uncircumcised. So what does this actually mean? What does it mean women are considered circumcised? So to understand this, we have to understand the deeper significance of circumcision. Circumcision, yes, is an act on the body, which is not done by women, but the true significance of circumcision expressed in the Torah, God says, there are times in the Torah where God says, I will circumcise your heart. What does it mean, circumcise your heart? Circumcision literally means removing the cover. That's what circumcision is. So the physical act is removing the cover. But the deeper significance is that there's a cover. There's a layer which separates between me and God. And bris reflects a certain removal of that cover, allowing me to have a direct connection with God. Every mitzvah has a deeper meaning. This is the deeper significance of the mitzvah of circumcision. And when the Talmud says women are considered circumcised, what it means is that women have a natural connection to God which men don't have. And this is expressed many times, that women are naturally more spiritual. Women have a natural connection greater than men. Men require circumcision, not only physically, but there's a greater effort which is required for men to remove that covering, to remove that layer of selfishness to connect to God. Women have that naturally. And that's why, being that they have it naturally, they have it spiritually, they don't require the physical circumcision because they don't require the spiritual circumcision because there's a natural spirituality that women have. And that's the deeper significance of this idea. So therefore, yes, circumcision is extremely important by men. Women have it naturally. And that's the Kabbalistic understanding of this mitzvah and why it was specifically given only to boys. Now, when we talk about circumcision, together with circumcision, we have baby naming. Okay, so naming is a very important part of Judaism. And the baby is named during the circumcision. One of the sources to this is that when Abraham was circumcised, God changed his name from Avram to Abraham. So already that's the first Jew, when he was circumcised, his name changed. That's when he was given his proper name. Let's read text number 6 on this. Yes, please.
Before a soul enters the body, it has no name. The soul itself has no need for a name, nor does a lifeless body have any use for a name. Rather, the function of the name is to join the soul with the body, the vitalizing energy that enters the soul to give life to the body is rooted in the name.
Okay, this touches on a very important idea. That is, most of us have a secular name and a Jewish name. But many people make the mistake. I just want to make sure what it is. Many people make the mistake of assuming that there is no difference between my Jewish name and my second. In other words, I have a second name and a Jewish name. Right? The truth is there is no comparison between your secular name, if someone's name is Joe, and the Hebrew name is Yosef. There is no comparison between the two names. The reason is the secular name is a name tag. I need to be called. So I have a name so that other people can call me. Theoretically, if I lived in my own little world and there's no other people there, I wouldn't need a name because nobody needs to call me. Judaism, the recognition of Judaism is that the name is an energy. The Hebrew name is an energy, is a certain life source. My neshama, the source, my soul, is expressed in my name. And therefore, when we name the child, we are actually bringing their neshama, their soul, a little bit closer, the grace causing a closer connection between them and the body. Because the soul is reflected in the name. And the name that I have, the Hebrew letters of my name, carries an energy. This is explained by Kabbalah, which explains some very important things. There is a custom among many Jews, or in many circles, most circles, that if God forbid someone has a terrible illness or someone is in a bad situation, they will add a name. Perhaps some of you are familiar with this idea of adding a name. Go to the Torah and add a name. What's the name they will add? Many times they'll add the name Chaim, which means life, or they'll add the name Raphael, which means healing. For a girl, there's Chaya, which also means life. There's different names which are supposed to impart, which mean life, which mean healing. Now, what's the point of adding a name? Why would a name add any, make the person get any sort of blessing? But if we recognize that every name has a certain energy, so Chaim, the name Chaim, has an energy of life, and we hope that the name will bring that energy to this person. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But the idea is that a name adds an energy because a name is a lot more than a name tag. So even if a person has nobody to talk to, they need a name because the name is their energy. Which is why a person should be very familiar with their Hebrew name. That's who I am. That's a lot closer. That's who I am. It's not just what they call me. That's who I am. You know, you don't have this in English, right? If someone's struggling financially, it wouldn't help if they, you know, you called them Richard, try and make him Richard. It's not gonna work with their secular names. In Hebrew names, that's what we have. And that's why a name becomes a powerful conduit between who I am, and which is why also many people will name names after other people. And it's not just to remind us of a grandfather or grandmother, it's that I want my child to have a certain strong connection to that person they're named after. And the energy of that person or the soul, the holiness of that person should be imparted to my child as well. It's interesting, it mentions over here on page 47 that there is a very different customs between Ashkenazic Jewry and Sephardic Jewry when it comes to naming children. With Ashkenaz, the custom is to name a child after one who has passed away, after a grandparent or a parent who has passed away, as opposed to Sephardic Jewry, where they name children after living parents, living grandparents. That's the very different. Yeah, it's considered a great honor after a grandparent who is alive, they name the children. So that's a differing reason. Now, moving on to text number 7. Let's read text number 7. Go ahead. So what does this mean? Again, the being that a name is a powerful energy that exists in this person, my Hebrew name is Shnei Or, so this name is an energy of existence. So how do the parents know? How can the parents know what this neshama is intended to be? What name this child? What's the energy of this child? So it says there's a certain element, you don't want to call them, it says the parents are prophets, but there's a certain element of divine providence where they are directed and guided to name their child a certain name, because their child is going to have this energy. So there's a certain sense of prophecy which parents have, because a name is not a name tag. A name is a lot more important than. Again, following the original line of thought, that life is about the fusion of holiness and physicality, that holiness is a certain energy. That's why we're all different. We're different physically, we're different spiritually. We each have a different purpose, a different mission. So the name is that energy I have. And each person has, each name, I'm sure, I don't know, I know when I do programs for children, I always encourage when they volunteer, I encourage them, tell me your Hebrew name. Most of them know, sometimes they don't know. It's important that children, adults, we should be familiar with our Hebrew name because it's a very strong part of who we are. My name is Shnei Or. I mentioned my name is Shnei Or. Lots of names. The roots of the names are also interesting. My name is Shnei Or, two, which means two lights. Where did the name Shnei Or come from? Shnei Or was, says there was two parents. They had a child, they had a son. The father wanted to name the boy Meir, which is a common Jewish name, which means his light. And the mother wanted to name the child after her father, grandfather, whose name was Yair, which also means two give life. Slightly different references of giving life. And they came to a conclusion, a compromise, we'll name the child Shnei Or, which represents the two lights. One commemorating Meir, which is one light, and Yair, the other light. That's the source of my name. It's interesting, I'm assuming you all have, if you're familiar with your Hebrew name, it's interesting to go back and look, what is the significance of your name? Where did it begin? Some of them are clear where they began, biblical names, but many Jewish names today are not biblical, and they have interesting origins. They just say a story about a couple who approaches a rabbi, and they ask him, we're arguing about what we should name our son. So she speaks, the mother says, I want to name him after my father, who was a righteous person, a God-fearing person. I'd like to name him after him. And my husband's grandfather was a crook. So I've no interest in naming my son after a crook. So the rabbi turns to the father and says, what about you? He says, the truth is my grandfather wasn't such a good person, but I'd like to honor his memory. I'd like to give him a name after him. You know, he may not have been such an honest person. So the rabbi turns to the mother and says, what was your father's name? And she says, my father's name was Moshe. He turns to the husband and says, what was your grandfather's name? He says, his name was Moshe. So he says, you know what, just name him Moshe. And in 20 years, we'll see who he's named after. Okay, we're going to skip the section of the Pidyon HaBen, and that's the significance of naming. We name the boy by the circumcision. We name the girl. The custom is to name the girl at the earliest opportunity, meaning that there is no circumcision. The custom is to name the daughter at the Torah at the earliest opportunity. There are various customs, but the custom to name the child early because you don't want to deprive the child of the energy that a name gives. I'm going to skip the section of Pidyon HaBen. It is an interesting topic, but rather move along to the Bar and Bat Mitzvah section. What is it, on page 49? Or, you know what, there's no one on page. Probably on page, 49. Okay. So, let's debunk two popular myths when it comes to Bar and Bat Mitzvah. This past summer, I was actually playing a game of baseball and I bumped into a person who was an older person, older than me, and he was about close to 40 years old, and he tells me, when I say older, the reason I'm explaining that, what I mean is that he said that although I'm close to 40 years old, I've never had a Bar Mitzvah. Relative to Bar Mitzvah, he was older. So he said, I've never had a Bar Mitzvah. And he wanted to know about how to have a Bar Mitzvah and what should be done. And you'll hear this. From time to time, you'll meet a person who says, I've never had a Bar Mitzvah, I've never had a Bat Mitzvah. And this is a mistake. Because the Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah is not the celebration. The Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah is becoming the age to now be obligated in the mitzvah, so now be responsible for keeping the mitzvah. So this is a big mistake. Unfortunately, in many circles today, the idea of Bar Mitzvah is the child prepares for the Bar Mitzvah, to make a huge celebration, and then it's over. That's it. You prepared, you've done it. That's it. So now you can move on. Now you don't have to come back to Hebrew school. There's nothing left to do. Huge celebration, and this is what the Bar Mitzvah is about. The event, the big party, you read from the Torah, that's the Bar Mitzvah. My brother-in-law who lives in Westchester, he had this conversation with someone. They made a huge Bar Mitzvah, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. So he turns to me and says, I can't imagine what you're going to spend on your son's wedding. He says, no, I'm not going to spend nearly as much on the wedding. He says, why not? I says, because I know a Bar Mitzvah is only going to happen once. He says, that's not going to spend so much. This is serious. And said, today Bar Mitzvahs are considered a greater expense than even weddings. Make a huge to-do out of the Bar Mitzvah, but afterwards there's nothing. And it's a terrible mistake. The Bar Mitzvah is the beginning. And a person can wake up in the morning of his Bar Mitzvah. Perhaps he doesn't even know it's his Bar Mitzvah. Or her Bat Mitzvah. Waking up, live a regular day of breakfast, lunch, and supper, and goes to sleep. That person has just experienced their Bar Mitzvah. This is not to take away, from the celebration. It's a reason to celebrate. But a Bar Mitzvah is the stage which a person reaches and now they become obligated. And the celebration is I'm celebrating the fact that today I have the opportunity to fulfill Torah Mitzvahs. And again, it's counterintuitive. It's wrong. It's a terrible mistake that so many people, they do the Torah Mitzvahs until the Bar Mitzvah, the education until then, and then it's done. It's a terrible mistake. But really, that's the beginning. This is the beginning of... So Bar Mitzvah is moving along from what we said earlier, is the next level of the fusion between the soul and the body. When a boy becomes 13, when a girl becomes 12, the soul now is completely integrated into the body. They are now, it's completely together. The soul is there in its fullest potential. Again, it started as a fetus, during birth, circumcision, naming, and now Bar Mitzvah, now the soul is completely there. Now here's the second mistake people make. That is, people understand that a Bar and Bat Mitzvah is when a child becomes an adult, which seems to conflict with American understanding that at age 12 and 13, we're not grown up, right? We celebrate and we talk to the boy and the girl. Today you're an adult, and the next morning we wake them up and say, you got to go to school, whether you like it or not. You're still a child, right? So are they a child or are they not? And, you know, in America, and rightfully so, a child, there's licenses, generally you're 16 or 18 years old, they can't drink or can make these decisions about drinking or smoking. So they're older, 18, 21. So perhaps that's different than Judaism. In Judaism, we believe that at 13 and 12, a child is a complete adult. And this, too, is a mistake. And the reason that's a mistake is because what actually happens at a bar mitzvah is not a state of fully, is not full adulthood. Rather, it's what we call is a bar da'ah. What happens at bar and bar mitzvah, what really happens when a child is 12 or 13? Why then do they become obligated in Torah mitzvahs? Are they smart enough? So, as is explained, what happens at bar mitzvah is not they become smart enough. Sometimes you'll have an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old who's a brilliant child prodigy, who's brilliant, and yet they're not obligated in Torah mitzvahs. They could be at a much more advanced age than boys or girls who are 14, 15 years old. And bar mitzvah is not about being smart enough. Bar mitzvah is about what's called das. And das means the ability to take what I know and integrate it into my behavior. And that's a different quality. You could have a child who's very smart, but even though they know a lot, their behavior is still that of a child. It could be brilliant, but their behavior is a child. Wisdom is about recognizing that what I learn should affect the way I behave, and therefore I should behave differently. When I hear something, when I hear about how I should live and what I learn, it'll translate into action. And that's a quality which a child or a girl and a boy have at age of 12 or 13. So again, it's not about brains, it's not about wisdom. It's about the ability to translate to that my mind should control my heart, as opposed to being two separate things. One of the customs of a boy when they become bar mitzvah is to put on tefillin. Tefillin connects the heart and the mind, which expresses this message, that my mind, what I understand, should control what I do. Children are wild. Children could misbehave, not because they don't know that it's right or wrong. I know that what I'm doing is wrong, but I don't care. Now, as a child, we don't care. I know that this is wrong, but it doesn't necessarily translate into my behavior. And it requires a certain maturity that what I understand is right is what I'm going to do is right. And it's at that age where we can hold children responsible not only to understand Torah, but that it should be expressed in their actions. Having said that, that doesn't mean that they become an adult in all areas. There's certain areas of adulthood which require life experience, such as, perhaps, one can argue driving, can argue the idea of alcohol or smoking if people choose to do so. This requires more life experience. A child is still maturing, is still understanding life as they get older, and requires a certain amount of life knowledge to then be responsible for certain areas, such as driving. A child at 12 is not experienced enough or doesn't have the wisdom to know how to drive yet. In Talmud also we have this idea where it says that a person under the age, according to Talmudic law, a person under the age of 20 cannot buy or sell real estate. That's what it says in the Talmud. Why? Because until 20, they don't have a true understanding and value for land. So you see this idea that even though at 12 and 13, they're already considered adults, but to value certain areas of life requires additional years. It could be 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. So the idea of the Torah of bar and bat mitzvah doesn't conflict with what we consider today in America to be an adult at 18 or 21. It's different stages. Bar and bat mitzvah means you are now at the age where you can understand something and then be held responsible to act it out. And that's something I believe we can relate to. Now, why is it that a boy becomes bar mitzvah at 13 and a girl at 12? So here we go to one of the first statements in the Torah regarding man and male and female. It says, when God took from Adam's side and built a woman, so the word yiven is the same word as bina. Yiven, and he built. What if God built the woman from built the woman? So the Talmud explains that it was built with additional understanding. That God endowed the woman with more understanding than that of men. And women have an additional understanding, additional clarity, and at age 12, they have already reached that level where they can be held responsible a year earlier than boys can be held responsible. And that's why, based on this, we have this idea that girls mature earlier and can be held responsible before boys can. I want to point out that it's been pretty quiet. hope I'm not putting everyone to sleep. If there's any questions or comments on this topic, on any of the topics, I mentioned birth and naming and bar bat mitzvah. Yes.
Shnei or. Is this the same thing that we were talking about before? Mayor and...
Yeah, well, Shnei or means two. Shnei means two in Hebrew. And Mayor means gives life. Yair means to give life. That's how that name was fused into two. Sorry, what did I say? Life. Life, I meant. Life. Mayor means gives life. But again, each name, are you... I don't want to put anybody on the spot here, but I'm assuming most people are familiar with their Hebrew names. So if somebody has any interesting anecdotes about their Hebrew names. Yes?
I just wonder how I got my Tzipporah bird.
Tzipporah?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure, but that's, you know.
Was there a Tzipporah in the Bible?
Yes. Tzipporah is the wife of Moshe. Moses. Moses is what? So Tzipporah.
I'm honored.
Yes. Are you married to a Moses, by any chance? No, no, okay. Yes.
Is it just the first name, or is it the middle name also? Some people have, let's say somebody's complete name is there.
Right, so both names are part of that idea. That's why we say we add a name, an additional name to their names. Just some interesting points about names. We mentioned earlier about how the body of, and I don't mean to talk about a negative topic of a stillborn, but the same idea that when someone is buried without a name, they are given a name upon burial as well. Even though it's not necessarily on the tombstone, because a name also is a certain connection to the body, that the body and the soul, there should be more holiness to the body, so that the body is named. There is a custom that when one, talking about naming children, it's a custom that if someone passed away in a tragic accident, or from a young age from an illness, they won't give the same exact name because it may have, you don't want to name someone after someone who had a certain bad mazel. So what they'll do is they'll give that name and an additional name. You know, so the name, I don't know, whatever it may be, the name of that person, and then add a name. So there's also probably you don't want to name someone directly after someone who had a certain negative mazel in their life. But a name is a very integral part of who the person is.
I have a question about names. So, how come for certain Jewish life, I mean, not even life cycles, I guess, you know, if you're called up to the Torah, you say Ben, father's name, and then for certain prayers, you say...
The mother's name.
Yeah.
Right, you say that by the Torah we call up the father, and then by... Tehillim, when we're praying for someone or we ask the request of someone, it's after the mother, and traditionally after a person passes away, it goes back to the father. So the name that we refer to the person once they've passed as the person, the son of the father. I'm going to have to get back to you on that. That's a good question. I don't know, we go back and forth. Yes?
I have a question about the bat mitzvah.
Okay.
When I was young, that age, nobody had a bat mitzvah. Like my friends who had daughters, they had bat mitzvahs, but when did this all start? Because it wasn't around when I was in that age. They had confirmation, but it wasn't.
There was no bat mitzvah.
No.
You know, that's a good question. And I don't know when it started. Again, going back to what we're saying, when did the celebrations about mitzvah begin?
No, when did it start? It wasn't
the girls, they didn't have bat mitzvah.
We didn't have bat mitzvah.
They didn't have the bat mitzvah celebration. No, they didn't make the party. The bat mitzvah happened at age 12. In other words, the idea of becoming obligated in mitzvah. No. I just want to clarify. I understand what you're saying. I was just saying, pointing out that too can be misunderstood by saying we didn't have a bat mitzvah, we didn't make a to-do out of it. At age 12, just as a boy became obligated at 13, a girl became obligated at age 12. It's not about the event, but just celebrated. By the way, I gave this class Sunday, and someone said, well, you know, I'm working very hard on an older man, said I'm preparing for my bar mitzvah now, and now you're taking... So the truth is not to take away from one who chooses later to make a bar mitzvah, but I pointed out, it's like, if you get a car, you celebrate the fact that I got a new car. You go out and you drive it, right? So that's so too. Bar mitzvah, we celebrate a bar mitzvah by recognizing today is the first opportunity that I can read from the Torah. There's no reason, there's no greater significance really to the boy reading the Torah on the first day of his bar mitzvah than a week later. It's just that today is the first opportunity I have to do the mitzvot that I can read from the Torah, so that's what I will do. But if someone, so that's why I explained to him, is I said, you've had this car in your garage since you're 13. You've never driven it yet. So whenever you drive it, it's a time to celebrate. You may have not, you kept in the garage for 20 years, but you've had it all along. A bar bat mitzvah, something that you've had all along, and perhaps it wasn't celebrated. So when you mentioned that you didn't have a bar mitzvah, for whatever reason, it wasn't celebrated. My guess would be, why wasn't it celebrated, is because the bar mitzvah is connected to much more, is connected much more to the reading from the Torah, or reading the Haftorah. And therefore, until recently, again, if you go back, not sure how long, but until recently, the reading for the Torah was done by boys. Today, I know in many communities, it's done by boys and girls. So today, perhaps, being that it's about the event, and about reading from the Torah, so today, bat mitzvah has gained more prominence. And I know sometimes bat mitzvah is on a 13 and 12, but if you follow the Talmud, where the whole idea of bar and bat mitzvah was initiated, bat mitzvah is 12, bar mitzvah is 13, and the Talmud doesn't mention anything about reading from the Torah, or making a party, or maybe making a celebration is, but all these different customs which are done are really side points to what is happening. I don't know, I'm not sure why it's more recent.
Do you just have to say bracha, or is there anything?
Nothing. You don't have to say anything. You wake up in the morning, you are bar mitzvah. You have had a bar mitzvah. You have now become obligated in mitzvahs.
You don't have to be called to the Torah.
Nope. You don't have to be called to the Torah. Absolutely not. Every Jewish... Now, I'll tell you the truth. When someone tells me that they haven't had a bar mitzvah, I don't immediately correct them. Because it may be an opportunity to get them to come and to make a celebrate mitzvah. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a wonderful thing. So I don't necessarily say, of course, let's study how to read from the Torah. We'll call you up. We'll give you a blessing. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a wonderful thing. But it's not correct in the sense that you have to be called up to the Torah to have a bar mitzvah. A person is bar mitzvah by virtue of them becoming 12 or 13 years old. In fact, what does the word bar and bat mitzvah mean? It means you now become the child. Bar means the son of. Bat means the daughter of. You are the son or the daughter of mitzvah. You are now... You now have the treasure of fulfilling mitzvahs. And that's just by becoming 12 or 13 years old.
Is that your Hebrew birthday, though?
Yes, the Hebrew birthday. The Hebrew birthday. Again, I know there are many customs and many different ways these are celebrated. I understand that today there's even a concept out there called a faux mitzvah, which is that non-Jewish kids who are part of, in Jewish circles, they feel left out. They don't have a bar mitzvah, so they make a celebration of a faux mitzvah. Because after 13, I'm also going to make a party. Something that actually happens. Because it's all about the party. And that's perhaps one of the biggest mistakes today, is that it's about the party. And it really is, the party is really a very small side effect of becoming bar mitzvah. Alright, any other... Okay, so that's hopefully a certain clarification. And what a bar mitzvah is all about. Let's move along to marriage. Okay, so those who have seen Fiddler on the Roof, right, have you perhaps are familiar with this concept, which is misconception that in Judaism, or in Orthodox Judaism, or in ancient Judaism, marriage was imposed. So Tevye imposes upon his daughter a shidduch, a match, and that marriage is imposed, and they kind of not given a choice. The boy is told who he's going to marry, the girl is told who she's going to marry. But the truth is, if you look in the Torah, it's very clear that both, this is a minor point, which today we come to appreciate, we know this in an obvious sense, but the Torah very clearly says that both the man and the woman should be aware and should know and decide who they should marry. How do we know that a woman should choose who she should marry? Text 9a is from the story which was mentioned in last week's Torah portion, read at the Torah. Actually, it's in text 9b. But let's read 9a and 9b together. I'm not sure where we're at.
A man may not betroth a woman who he has not seen, of whom he has not approved.
Okay. So that's actually regarding the man. 9a says that a man has to approve, in other words, it has to be a decision. He knows her, it can't be arranged. This idea of purely arranged marriage cannot be. The man can't be arranged to marry a woman. He has to know and agree to who he's marrying. The flip side of that is, 9b. What is that a reference to? When Eliezer, Abraham sends his assistant, to servant Eliezer, to go find a wife for Yitzchak, for Isaac. Because Isaac, interestingly, never left the land of Israel. Among the three forefathers, they all traveled. Isaac never left Israel. He stayed in Israel his life. And Abraham knew that was intended. And he said, I can't send my son away to find the match. I'm going to have to send someone to find the match for him. So he sends Eliezer, and she meets Rebecca. He meets Rebecca, and he tells Rebecca's father and parents and brother that I would like to take Rebecca to Isaac. So what do they respond? They say, let us summon her and ask her. Why would the Torah tell us this? If you recall, last week we mentioned that every verse in Torah is to teach me a lesson. And a lot of the conversation between Eliezer and Lavan and Bisul is not recorded. So why is this verse recorded? The Talmud tells us, Mikam She'in Messiah Nesaisha Elamitaita, and that's text 9c. From here we learn that a woman may only be married with her consent, with her agreement to who she's married. Today, we may look at this and say, well, obviously, of course, men and women, we were supposed to know who we marry. We should choose who we marry. But perhaps when the Talmud is written, again, several thousand years ago, this was not necessarily the case, where parents may have married off a son to a girl, or the girl to a certain boy against their will, regardless of whether they liked it or not. And that's why a lot of times when we learn from the Talmud certain values which today are so commonplace, and we think that obviously this is a value, we have to recognize that many of what today's values are based in Judaic values. Based on the fact that even though 500 years ago, when there was a world which was very male-dominated in certain areas of slavery, many of today's values which weren't accepted, but over time we've accepted many of the values in the Torah and the Talmud. For example, this, that marriage should be with the agreement of both the husband and wife. However, moving past that, and continuing on the chain of what we've discussed since the beginning of today's class, which is the fusion of the body and the soul, marriage too is a very significant and very holy event. Because while each person is a soul with the body, however, Torah understands that man and woman each are a half. We each are half a being, and we find each other is really the connection of two halves into one. Towards the end of this year, there's a whole course on marriage, and we discussed this somewhat last year as well. But marriage, according to Kabbalah, is really where two half souls find each other. And therefore they become one. So it really becomes the final step of the neshama. Yes, each person is complete on their own, ready by the bar and bat mitzvah. But marriage is two halves, which is why the very first marriage between Adam and Eve, how did it begin? Adam was one, then he was separated into two, and then they were brought back together again. And each marriage is a replica of that. That originally there's one soul, which is then separated and then brought back together in marriage. And that's why marriage is such an awesome celebration. It's not just about two people, which are now finding each other. It's really about two halves, which found its own completion. So why in Judaism, marriage is a very powerful event. Some of you may have been to an orthodox wedding. And I know that someone was describing how a woman who was not not an Orthodox woman, she went to a Hasidic wedding for the first time. It's actually happened. And she said she went to the wedding, and she, by the chuppah, so they went to a chuppah. The chuppah is extremely somber, very sad. It's almost sad. The tune which is played is sad, not sad, but very serious. She turned to the person standing next to her, and she said, "Well, I know." And she said to me, "No, I've never been to such a somber wedding in my life." And then that ended the chuppah, and there was a cracking, the breaking of the glass. And then was the celebration afterwards, and there's the dancing, and these weddings are extremely joyous and powerful. And then she walked out of the hall to catch her breath, and she happened to find herself standing next to the same person she was standing next to by the chuppah. And she turned to him and she said, "You know, I've never been to such a joyous wedding in my life." And the truth is that when this person who was standing next to him thought about it, he said, "You know what, these two ideas really go hand in hand. They're not mutually exclusive at all. Because the wedding is so powerful, because we recognize at the moment of the chuppah, which is really the moment of marriage, we recognize that what an awesome moment this is. Very serious moment. Two souls are coming together to begin a united purpose, a united mission in life. because it's such a unique, such a powerful event, therefore later by the celebration, it's a much deeper and more significant celebration. We're not just dancing because there's good food, because two people are getting married. We're dancing because we appreciate the significance of what's happening here. Because two halves have become one. Because two units have become one unit to now embark on a new mission in this world. To now continue to bring life to this world together. So if we take it seriously, if we recognize the significance of it, then the joy is much deeper, the joy is much more powerful, the joy is much more intimate and deep. And that's what a wedding, that's what a Jewish wedding is, continuing on this line of the, that we talk about life as a wedding, a fusion in body and soul. So wedding is about bringing two halves together. We're now going to embark on a mission in life, which is, why we have many interesting customs by a Jewish wedding. It says, because a relationship, and to go back to what this idea of a wedding really is about, how, you know, today statistics show that close to 50% of marriages end in divorce. And it's, I think that's the same in all circles, the same in here in America, in Israel, the same statistics show. But what may be, there may be a very powerful key in traditional Judaism which teaches us about marriage, which may help us to maintain healthy relationships. And that is that in Judaism, we recognize that there is the elements of who we are, which you can categorize in how we feel and what we do and how we think and how we speak. And when we come together, right now we are compatible. Right now we get along. Right now we benefit one another. But many times the marriage is really about how I enjoy being with my spouse. My spouse enjoys being with me. There's a certain pleasure we give one another. We feel good around one another. We each are benefiting each other. But in a sense, you can say that there's an animalistic sense to that. That I am happy together with this person. This person is happy together with me. Inevitably, in life, there are going to be times where we are not going to get along. Where I am not going to benefit my spouse, and my spouse is not going to benefit me. So if my marriage, if a relationship is about what I benefit from it, so at a point where we don't benefit, so then what really is keeping my marriage together? Why should the marriage stay together? After all, the purpose of marriage is that we feel good in the company of one another. But if we recognize this idea, that marriage is about two units coming together as a soul with a certain mission in life, marriage is not only about what it means to me, but we are intended for each other to now make the world a holier place as on a Jewish mission, on a mission of our souls. So it's not only about what's good for me. There's a certain much deeper purpose to us being together. We are intended to be together to serve others, to serve the world, to make the world a better place. We have a united mission. And so even in a moment, or at times, we're having a bad day. We're having a bad period of time. But my connection to her and her connection to me is not only about if it makes me happy at the moment. It's a lot deeper. It's about that together we are here for a purpose. We are intended to be with one another. We are one soul with a mission in the world. Just as birth itself is a mission of the soul and the body, marriage is a united mission. And if we have that common goal, so that's kind of, that's outside of the circle. You have a circle and you have outside of the circle. The circle is who we are and how we make each other happy. And that's extremely important. Marriage should be between two people who bring happiness to one another. But there has to be that deeper significance of marriage, that outside of my little life, we have a purpose together. We have a mission together. There's a certain selflessness to our marriage that we're here together, one another, to serve others, to serve the world, to serve God. And then being that there's a selfless element to my marriage, so even if at the moment it doesn't make me happy, there's a deeper bond. There's something a lot deeper than the moments that make each other happy. And perhaps that's the key to keeping a healthy relationship through tough times. And this idea of a ring, this idea is really represented in a circle. That there's you and there's me, there's the two halves, but we're surrounded by God. We're surrounded by a united purpose, by a united mission in life. And as you'll find, there is the three rings in marriage. Oh, there's a joke about the three rings in marriage. There's the engagement ring, and there's the wedding ring, and then there's the supper ring. But there's there's really the three circles in marriage, which represent this idea. We have the ring where the bride circles the groom seven times. This idea of circling, that's the first element of a circle, where she circles the groom. Why is she circling? Because of this idea that we're surrounding ourselves with holiness, we're surrounding ourselves with the presence of God. That's where the custom of circling the groom comes. Seven times is a Kabbalistic idea. The custom is that the groom gives the bride the ring. And the moment of the ring, the moment that the ring is placed on the bride, that's the moment of marriage. Custom is to say, Hareyat Mikudeshet Li, the Taba'at Zo, Kedat Moshe Yisrael, through this ring, you are betrothed to me. That is the moment of Kiddushin. That is the moment of marriage. It's usually a simple ring. But the truth is, according to Jewish legality, it doesn't have to be a ring. Could it be anything of true value? If it's passed from him to her, he could say those words. So the custom, the ancient custom, is with the ring, because this idea of a circle. We're surrounding ourselves. It's not just me, it's not just you. There's something surrounding us which makes our marriage, the united function of our marriage. And the third one is not really a circle, it's more the chuppah. But the same idea, we cover ourselves, we're not standing alone, we're standing under the awning of something higher than us. Almost like a kippah is intended to be a reminder of something above us. The chuppah too, where the bride and groom stand under, is a reminder that we are coming together under the unison of God. And it's interesting, the Hebrew words ish and isha, very similar. I mean, we don't have a slide for this lesson on the book, but the Hebrew letters for the word man is ish, aleph, yud, shin. The Hebrew letters for the woman is isha, aleph, shin, hey. If you follow along, good. If you don't, that's fine also. Aleph, yud, shin, aleph, shin, hey. Both very similar. They both have an aleph and a shin, which means fire. But then the together with the aleph and shin, the man has a yud, ish, aleph, yud, shin, there's a yud, and the woman has a hey, aleph, shin, hey. If you take the two letters, yud and hey, that makes up the word yud, hey, which is God's name. So you have each, the male and the female both are ish, which means fire, but when you put them together, side for the fire, you have the yud, hey, you have God's name, which Kabbalists explained to me. That as long as there's God's name there, you have properly have an ish and isha. You have, if you allow God into your marriage. But if you take away God, you take away the yud and the hey, what you're left with is ish and ish of fire. And many times fire can, unfortunately, consume the marriage. So the idea is, if we allow God into the marriage, you have the yud and the hey, you have God after the letter of the marriage. I can clarify that further if you want to perhaps later. Yes?
I actually have a question about the second ring.
Okay. The second, what do you mean the second ring?
I just want to see. Everybody
may
know the answer,
but
I'm not sure. Where is the tradition about having
a
solid gold ring
coming into play? That's a great question. Where is a solid gold ring? So the reason of a gold ring, actually relatively simple, is because it's important, as it's almost like a legal event. It's important that the woman and people and the witnesses also. It's very important to have witnesses there. This is an act of marriage with witnesses, should know the value of the item. Now, a solid gold ring is relatively easy to recognize its value. It's pretty clear. You know it's gold. That's why the custom is that it's not done with a diamond. Because a diamond, one can never know the value of a diamond. So, you know, depending on certain intricacies of the diamond, it could be worth several thousand, it could be worth much more or much less. So we want to give something which is clearly identifiable what the value of this object is, and therefore it's a proper exchange of value, and it's clear, at least ballpark, to know how much is being exchanged from him to her. And that's where the custom is. Also, a certain simplicity represents a lack of flamboyance. You know, I'm not trying to outdo, it's a simple act of a simple ring. But that's why it's done with a simple gold band. I'm going to move now to the final step. I know we only have 10 minutes left, so we're going to skip a certain portion where it describes how the marriage is an act, which is the marriage is very similar to the gift to the Torah being given at Sinai, which is many of the events of Sinai was considered the marriage Shir HaShirim. Sinai is considered the marriage between God and the Jewish people. So to our marriage, the chuppah, many of the customs which is done at the chuppah is a reminder of what happened at Sinai. Just to go through quickly on the board, matchmaker, So too we have Moses was intermediary between God and Israel. He's the one who suggested it. And that's the idea of a matchmaker. The bride's hometown custom is to have the wedding in the bride's hometown. So too, the Jewish people were like the bride. The Torah was given here on earth, on our turf, and the bride's hometown. We escort the bride with candles, just as the Torah was escorted. When God came to Sinai, God came down on Sinai, there was lightning was seen at the giving of the Torah. We break the glass, reminder of the destruction of the temple, as well as a reminder of Moses breaking the tablets. We have dancing, somersaults, this idea that what was up went down. God, which was above, came down onto the mountain. The Jewish people were lifted. That which was down went up. And the ring, God betrothed us with the Torah, which is like a ring that surrounds us. And this is expressed much deeper and much more at length in the marriage discussions as well. Perhaps we'll get to that later in the year. So this is basically explaining that how the soul enters the body, and over time, this fire, the soul within us, grows and becomes more complete. We have the naming, we have the bar and bat mitzvah, we have marriage, and we have mitzvot. Each of these, I am more and more surrounded, or more filled with my soul and the potential than my soul, my ability, and properly compared to a candle, because it's a shining light in the world, makes the world a holier, warmer place to live in. And this is continuing that idea with the four stages of how the soul enters the body. Now, an interesting side point before we move on to the customs of bereavement and the one who passes on is that when one gets married, there's the obligation to have children. It's actually the very first commandment to have children, both to Adam and to Noah, to have children. However, the commandment to have children is only given to men. Seems kind of strange because a man would have a hard time having a child on his own. But the commandment to have children is only to men. The mitzvah of having children is for men and women equally. And this is where you have this idea that sometimes you can do a mitzvah without being commanded to do so. Why would there be a commandment to men? And for women, it's only a mitzvah. If they choose to do so, it's a mitzvah, but they're not obligated. So one of the reasons is because childbirth can be dangerous for a woman. And Torah would not obligate, God would not obligate a woman to put herself through such pain and such danger. There cannot be such an obligation. So the man has an obligation to have children. The man has to find a woman who's willing to have children. The woman is not obligated because, again, they can't be obligated to put their lives on the line. At the same time, women have a greater, perhaps, therefore, God created women with a more natural desire to have children, so that children will be born. So they'll fulfill this incredible mitzvah. But there is no obligation because, again, we're never obligated to put ourselves in danger for Torah mitzvahs.
Okay.
How
do you what's the definition of a mitzvah?
Okay, so that's where there is a mitzvah literally means commandment. However, on a deeper level, if you look at the Aramaic word mitzvah, tzavta really means a connection. The tzavta is more of a connection than a commandment. God doesn't just simply give us commandments and, oh, I want to see if you'll follow the rules, but there's actually, each mitzvah is an opportunity to connect. And that's where you have that many mitzvahs, that's where I need to find the difference. Where some mitzvahs, where in this situation, a man has an obligation, a woman has the opportunity to make that connection, but she's not commanded to make that connection. So that's where you have the alternative, the second meaning to the word mitzvah. We'll move to page 62. And we go to the many customs connected with one who passes. Again, and really connected to all the discussions today. They're all very close to home, right? We all connect, relate to the bar mitzvah. We all relate to birth. We all relate to the idea of passing with the family members, with people who we are close with. And Judaism is a very, I believe, a beautiful way of handling the saddest moments within life, the moments of death. So the first statement on page 62, text 16a, we have an interesting comparison of what death or what passing is. Page 16a, text number 16a.
One who is present at the time of a person's passing is required to address the scroll. This is because a person's passing is likened to the burning of a Torah scroll.
And we know from the prophets that when one sees a scroll of Torah which is burnt, one is required to rip their clothing. And there is a burial which is done for Torahs which are desecrated, which are burnt. This is actually a picture from 1903, the pogrom in Kishinev, and they bury the Torahs. What is the comparison, though, between the passing of a person and the burning of a Torah scroll? And aside from the fact that it's the end of two beings, but what would be the comparison? So Nachmat the Ritva in text 16b provides somewhat of an explanation on this, page 63, text 16b. Nachmanides, that's the Ramban.
Nachmanides will bless memory explain that the soul in the body is like the parchment of the Torah scroll that is inscribed with the God's name.
The parchment, so here we go back to the very beginning of the discussion, the very beginning of the test. If life is the fusion of a body and a soul, just like the Torah is parchment, for that parchment itself, when the leather is the parchment is laid out, it can become anything. It can become a pair of shoes, it can become a book, and it becomes a Torah scroll because the Hebrew words and God's names are inscribed in it, giving it ultimate holiness. The body, too, is skin and bones, and we can compare the body to the body of an animal. But by placing a godly soul into it, we become a human being, we become a holy being. But once we become a holy being, the body too is holy. Just as the Torah scroll, once the letters are written on the Torah scroll, the parchment itself becomes holy. So therefore there is a lot to compare between the soul of a person and the body and a Torah scroll, which is made holy. The parchment, which is physical material, made holy with the inscription on it. The body is physical, made holy with the soul inside of it. The body becomes holy just as the Torah becomes holy. And many people, they have the custom, to use the covering of a Sefer Torah to become the shrouds for one who passes on. And this is the reason why the clothing is torn when someone is in the presence of one who passes on, is required to tear their clothing. Now, interestingly, originally, the halacha was, the custom was, that anyone who is in the presence of one who passes away must tear their clothing. However, now the custom is only family members. Only family members tear their clothing. The custom is to tear the right part of the shirt or the jacket. If it's a child, the child tears the left side because it's more painful, so we tear the side which is closer to the heart. So that's the custom regarding tearing clothing.
If your parent dies,
you tear the left side. No, the left side. So it's closer to the heart. You recognize how it's more painful closer to the heart.
So I think we misunderstood the question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought you were saying if your child passes.
No, I'm sorry. No.
I tear my left side.
I'm not sure about a child.
My parent passes. I tear the left side.
The child of one who passes away would tear the garment on the left side, which is closer to the heart. A sibling would tear it on the right side.
Okay.
Not sure about a parent to a child. I'd imagine. I'm not sure. However, it used to be everyone would tear their garments. And the reason they stopped that is because, you know, today we have a lot of, we open our closets, plenty of clothing. It used to be people had only a few pairs of clothing. And because they didn't want to tear their clothing, they would refrain from going to the bedside of one who passes away. And to be surrounded by people when one passes away is considered to be a real zechut. It's considered a real merit. To be surrounded by other people is considered a real respect to the body of the person. To be near other people. And therefore, they didn't want people refraining from going to the bedside of those who are about to die. So therefore, they said only family members should tear their clothes. But the idea is that the passing of anyone is a very powerful moment. It's a very holy moment. It's the moment, and therefore, really, it's a requirement on everyone to mourn, everyone to tear their clothes.
If you're not with your parents,
yes, the answer is that
you
would do it when you find out.
As soon as you find out,
yes. Someone who has to sit shiva would do it immediately as soon as they find out. However, because we recognize the holiness of the body, the holiness of the soul, again, the body is holy, just as the parchment of the Torah became holy. So then even when the soul leaves the body upon death, the body is still an extremely holy artifact. And this is, I don't want to say artifact, it's really an extremely holy being. And this is expressed in many ways, And we'll go through this first on page 63, text 16c. Go ahead.
All those who handle the dead must be aware that they are involved with the whole living. The human body is not only the container that serves the exalted soul, but has itself become sanctified with an independent holiness similar to the soul.
So the body is now holy. And therefore, the body has to be treated with tremendous holiness. And the body becomes something which the entire community has to concern itself about, as is expressed in text 17a, which is a very strange halacha. Page 64. Go ahead.
When a person dies, all the inhabitants of the city are forbidden
to work. It'll be very hard, especially in a big city. So how what does this even mean? What it means is that every person has an obligation to tend to the body. The body is holy, the body needs to be taken care of, the body is respectful. Just as if, God forbid, you saw a Sefer Torah on the floor, everyone would rush to pick it up. That's the holiness of the body right now. And everyone has an obligation to take care of it. Now, it's, practically speaking, it would be very hard for the entire city to stop working, so therefore in text 17b, it clarifies how this can be handled. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
If there are shifts in the city, with every shift tending to the dead on a designated day, then on their off days, members of other shifts may work, even if there is a deceased person that needs to be cared for.
So basically what this establishes, by the way, I'm sorry, I'm going a couple minutes over time. I apologize for that. What this establishes is that, yes, we all have an obligation, but if we designate a group of people to tend to the body, so then there is a group designated. But there has to be a group designated, therefore the body has to be treated with utmost respect. And it becomes everyone's obligation to make sure that there's a chevra kadisha, there's a burial society tending to the bodies. And there are various customs while the body is being taken care of, which shows our respect for the body. First of all, when the chevra kadisha are taking care of the body, it says there is no joking or jocular talk around the body. It has to be a certain aura of seriousness and holiness. The body is covered if and when possible. Men tend to male bodies, women tend to female bodies. There's a respect and dignity given to the body. The body is always facing up. These are various halakhas and customs which various societies are very familiar with. All sorts of different areas which express a constant awareness and respect for the body. And perhaps the most significant way the body is respected is in text 18.
We maintain a watch over the dead out of respect. For if we were to leave the body alone, it would appear as if we abandoned it like a utensil that is no longer desired.
So the body is never left alone, because we constantly care for the body. If something left alone represents the idea that it's not cared for. From the moment the person passes on, so they're buried, we try, if and when possible, certain circumstances don't allow for it, to have constantly a person there. Generally, the custom of the person says to him. I read an article a couple years ago, interesting article from the city of Detroit, talking about the economic hardship. So there's a morgue there for bodies of people who can't afford, or whose families can't afford to bury them. And the government has a fund, but the fund only gives so much slowly. So as soon as there's enough money to bury a body, they bury one of the bodies. But there's such a morgue for bodies of their family or people can't afford to bury them. And in the article, it was about Detroit, how recently that there's more people in that morgue. But then the person, the mortician, writes, how rarely do I ever have a Jewish or a Muslim body here? He says, why? Because they take care of, the community takes care of them. So this is a very practical idea which is kept till today in a very practical way, that our bodies are respected, they're tended to, they're cared for, because they're holy. Because the body is holy, again, going back to the beginning of life. The soul is infused in the body becomes a holy entity, a holy being. Text 19 expresses this further.
Man was created in God's image, just as there is no difference between a complete Torah scroll and one letter from the Torah scroll. As both must be treated with utmost respect, it is forbidden to accord disrespect to even a single bone from a sacred body. The sacred bodies that were created in God's image.
There's the holiness connected to the body. I want to move along quickly. Just having said all this, we speak about the body, the respect for the body. There's also the recognition that the soul continues. The person continues. Which goes into a whole different discussion of a Kaddish and all these areas where we can continue to connect to the person, to the soul of the person. Which is expressed in the Talmud on page 67.
When a righteous person, text 20b, when a righteous person is lost, he is lost to his generation. This can be compared to a person who lost a diamond. The diamond is lost to its owner, yet the diamond, wherever it may be, remains a diamond. The diamond is still a diamond. The soul continues. We're not exactly aware of what happens after life. Life continues. The soul continues. We don't know exactly how and what. The diamond is there, and we can connect to it through actions, through kaddish, through different good things, in memory of one who has passed on. The loss is for the world. Loss is for us who don't see this soul, don't see this person anymore. And that's also reflected in the tearing of the clothing, where we kind of send the message. The clothing is torn. The very outer surface is torn. The inside, the essence of the being hasn't changed. Externally, things have changed. We don't see this person, we're not aware of this person, but as a family member, as someone who's close to this person, the internal connection still exists. And then we conclude with the comforting that we give on text 21a, the comforting we give is, may God comfort you among the other mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. Why are we connecting one's pain to Zion and Jerusalem? So I'll read 21b out loud. This is a letter which was written by the Rebbe Nachum Mendel Schneerson of blessed memory. He wrote this to Ariel Sharon when his son tragically was killed in a tragic accident at the age of 10, his son Gur. It was 1967, and he wrote as following. He said, even in such a great tragedy, a modicum of solace, and even more than a modicum, is expressed in our traditional text of consolation to mourners. May the Almighty comfort you among the other mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. The Romans and the Babylonians before them were able to destroy the holy temple of wood and stone, of gold and silver. But no nation can lay hands on the inner holy temple in the heart of every Jew, for it is eternal. The same applies to every personal loss. The hand of death can only touch the body and its concerns, but the soul is eternal. It has simply ascended to the world of truth. And that is the idea. We comfort people. We recognize, just as we are all mourners of Zion, God, that our temple was destroyed, our homeland was destroyed, and we pray today on a wall of a broken down edifice, but we recognize the essence of the temple, the essence of the holiness was never taken away. The essence of the person can't be taken away. And the tragedy is painful, and very painful, maybe too painful to bear, but recognize that there isn't that complete disconnect. The connection is still there. The connection is still there. The outer surface, the building of it has been destroyed, but the essence of it remains fully intact. And this is the final idea of, this is the significance of how we relate to passing and how we respect the body. The utmost respect for the body, at the same time understanding the soul continues and the relationships we've had continue as well. So this, we conclude this topic. Again, just a couple of notifications, upcoming events. This is already a month away. We have a Hanukkah Wonderland, the week of Hanukkah, which is December 18th. We're doing this at the Orchard Lake Mall. The Monday class and Israel trip. Just those who'd like to follow along with a conclusion of this course, of this today's class, today's discussion, as we go through quickly what we discussed. We began with the discussion of life being like a wedding feast, an opportunity to make the most of every moment. That's the significance of life, bringing a fusion of two opposites, like the fusion of the bride and the groom. Move on to discuss the fetus is taught the Torah in utero, so the Torah will naturally resonate with the soul throughout life. We then express what is birth. Birth and birthdays are extremely important, extremely significant, because it's when the soul and the body come together to begin its mission. And for a boy, by the bris milah circumcision, the neshama comes in its completion, it's given a name. For a girl, it happens at birth, or by the naming, and the name represents the mission and the energy connected to the Hebrew letters of that name. In bar and bat mitzvah, a child has the capacity to tell the right from wrong, and therefore that happens on the birthday, regardless of how it is celebrated. Wedding, either man or woman may be married without consent. Marriage, too, is the fusion of two halves into one being, now begin a journey together in this world. We didn't really get into this, but many of the customs of the wedding mirror that which occurred when the Torah was given at Sinai. The only men are obligated in the midst of having children. Women have the credit of doing the mitzvah, but the obligation can only be to man. The woman who goes through the painful experience can't be obligated to do that. And we concluded with saying the body that houses soul and life must continue to be respected, treated with respect, even after the soul has departed. This is expressed in many customs, and this is very practically seen and how much respect is given to the body even after passing. That's the conclusion of today's topic. Again, please send me any questions, an email, or a phone call. Sundays next week, those of you who perhaps received the email, this coming Sunday is class number 3. I will be out of town. Class will be given by my father. I learned everything from him, so he knows a lot more than I do. That would be Sunday morning, next Thursday, Thanksgiving. Those who would like can come here Tuesday night. I know it maybe doesn't fit into your schedule. We will have this class number 3 next Tuesday night, 7 o'clock at the Federation building. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.